From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Police killings of Americans are a routine occurrence, something that people in other developed nations find exceedingly strange. But our law enforcement officers kill so many people that media outlets felt the need to keep careful track, especially in the absence of proper government accounting. The Washington Post became one of the first media outlets to start tracking fatal police shootings, and my guest is part of the team that began the paper's database. In his 2016 book, They Can't Kill Us All, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Wesley Lowery, who led the Post's team in Ferguson, humanized the victims of police brutality. Mike Brown, Tamir Rice, Freddie Gray, and countless more names of fallen Americans. They Can't Kill Us All, which became a New York Times bestseller, is now out in paperback. And in the context of Donald Trump's presidency, the issue takes on a greater urgency. Wesley Lowery covers law enforcement and justice for The Washington Post, and he was a member of the team that won the Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting for coverage of police shootings. He now joins me to discuss his book. Welcome to the show, Wesley.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you start your story in Ferguson, where you became the first journalist to himself be arrested when thousands of people and journalists converged into a place that became the sort of flashpoint that threw the issue of on the slogan of Black Lives Matter into the national spotlight. While that slogan had been born after Trayvon Martin was killed, it really became a household name after Mike Brown's death. But that, of course, is not the first time that the issue of police brutality broke into the national news. Why was that such a seminal moment for the story of the struggle for Black lives?
Of course. I mean, I think a big part of the reason that 2014 was such a seminal moment was because of what had happened previously in 2012 and 2013, right? And so that's that rewind back to the Trayvon Martin case, as well as the Jordan Davis case, both in 2012, in which in those cases did not involve police officers. They both involved, in fact, white vigilantes who shot and killed the young Black teenagers. But in both of those cases, there was a massive public outcry, there was anger and pain, but there were calls to let the system play out, wait and see what happens, right? In both of those cases, at least initially, you had the two men involved, Michael Dunn and George Zimmerman, acquitted of those crimes. Eventually, Michael Dunn is convicted and ends up serving jail time, but in the short term, the feeling of justice does not exist in either of those cases. Then moving forward, you know, 2013, which is when the jury decisions happen in both of those cases, you'd also have the movie Fruitvale Station comes out portraying the death of Oscar Grant, which was previous in 2009. And so you have this kind of building sense of injustice among Black America. You've entered the second term of a Black president in President Obama, and you have this kind of cascading frustration. And then Michael Brown is killed, and then people see the images of his body staying in the street for all of those hours. People have questions. The Ferguson police puts out two sentences saying, basically, there was an altercation and then we shot him, providing no information about what happened. And in that void of information, there was rumors, there was innuendo, there was all types of conversation about what may or may not have happened. And so you had tensions that had been simmering at this point for several years, finally boiling over in the streets of Ferguson.
When you reported from the streets of Ferguson, what were some of the things that stood out to you in terms of what ordinary people were feeling? I mean, unfortunately, there has not really been justice in Ferguson. There was revealed to be much more than just Mike Brown's death at the hands of Darren Wilson. There was systemic targeting by police of that town's Black residents. But at that moment, when this little-known town was in the national scene, what were some of the conversations you had with people who were seeing this convergence, national convergence in their streets?
Of course. You know, it was striking how many people I talked to during those first few days who had just horrific anecdotes, right? I was walking the streets, talking to residents, talking to people, expecting in many cases to receive anecdotes or information about their interactions with police. And you always, when you ask people questions like that, expect to hear some negative things, some bad things. But the stories I was hearing very early on about the number of people who had arrest warrants, about people spending nights in jail for traffic tickets, about incidences in which someone called for an ambulance and the police showed up instead, incidents of police dogs being sent after children, right? You're hearing kind of horror stories over and over and over again. What was interesting was at the beginning, I think myself and all the other reporters who were there early were hearing a lot of these stories. We didn't necessarily report all of them out at the time because there was a sense of, one, can all of these folks really be telling the truth? Is it really this bad here? But two, how are we going to prove this? How are we going to get the records? How are we going to get the documents? Months later, when the Department of Justice puts their Patterns and Practices report out about the Ferguson Police and the St. Louis County Police, what they conclude essentially is that all of those things we are hearing about anecdotally were happening at a broad scale. That you had a city, a municipality, and as well as a collection of municipalities in St. Louis County profiting off of the poverty of its residents, using aggressive speed traps and speed ticketing that then lead to arrest warrants to essentially trap so many of their residents in poverty and punish them for the fact that they may not be able to pay for a new license or registration, for example. And so what we saw was a massive municipal court system that was more or less sucking money out of the pockets of residents for very minor traffic offenses and using that to funnel it into the city budgets. And so what we saw was essentially a community of people who had almost no trust, almost no relationship with their police. And that was the context in which Michael Brown was killed. And now they were seeing a teenager dead in their streets and wanted to know why.
Right. And Ferguson being this small town in the United States, of course, not really small town because it's right near St. Louis. So it is part of a bigger metropolitan area. But then you see these similar stories being played out in city after city. And because of what had happened in Ferguson, they take on added urgency. The other story that you tell in your book of many stories is, of course, the heartbreaking story of Tamir Rice, 12-year-old mm-hmm. child. You know, Mike Brown was a teenager too, but Tamir Rice was not even a teenager. He didn't even get to make it to his 13th birthday. And his story should have been the last such story of this happening, but it wasn't. Tell me a little bit about the work you did in Cleveland and how people reacted to the police killing of this little boy.
Of course. Yeah, you know, Tamir Rice is killed in 2014, not long after Michael Brown's death. And this is a case that is very hard for a lot of people. You know, it's a story of a 12-year-old boy playing with a toy gun in a park. You can see in the video, the police officers approach him. They drive very close up to him, jump out of their vehicle, and then they get scared. They say that maybe he's reaching for something, and they shoot and kill him. And you watch this play out in a black and white video. You know, this is a very difficult case for a lot of people because I saw a young boy. This is a case of a boy with a gun, not some hardened criminal or someone who could be caricatured as, you know, a thug. You know, this was a child. Now, Cleveland's my hometown. It's where I grew up. It's where my family still lives. And so I flew back home to Cleveland to cover this case not long after I was done spending my time in Ferguson. What was interesting was that, you know, Cleveland has a long history of frustrations, as most places do, between their black community and their police. Cleveland at the time and to this day was facing an uptick in murder, and there was a lot of conversation around policing and what that looks like and whether it should be more aggressive or not. And you had an activist core that had been beginning to grow during the Occupy Wall Street years, but that had died off for a little bit. It was now rejuvenated by the Tamir Rice case. But many people in Cleveland remember the shooting from several years prior to that, involving Officer Michael Brillo, in which, more than 100 bullets were shot at two unarmed people in a shooting that is still being litigated to this day, right? And so there was this frustration in Cleveland that that they had seen and they'd heard of a terrible shooting before. It happened not too long earlier, and now here they were finding about this child that had been killed. It was interesting. You know, Cleveland's a city where the police union and the police still hold a lot of political power, and there's a lot of frustration on their part. They thought perhaps these officers are not receiving, you know, due process or a fair shake. There's a lot of frustration even among the police that this officer involved in the Tamir Rice shooting, Timothy Lohman, had even been hired. He was an officer with a very colored history. He was someone who had been kicked out of a suburban police department previously, and there was a real question of whether or not the Cleveland police did their due diligence in hiring him. But as is often the case, in these shootings, is almost always the case in these shootings, the officer who killed Tamir Rice, Timothy Loman, was not charged with a crime for killing Tamir. And I think that that's something that people found frustrating. When we started reporting in Ferguson, we thought at the time, rather naively, well, if the officer did something wrong, then he'll be charged, right?
Right.
Why don't we wait and see what happens? What we know is that that's not the case, that in the vast majority of cases, 99.9% of these cases, no matter the circumstances, armed or unarmed, child, man, woman, officers are not charged in fatal shootings.
And that is, of course, the issue, that beyond the individual stories of Tamir Rice, Mike Brown, Freddie Gray, Walter Scott, are the stories of people whose names have been forgotten, whose names didn't even make the national news, but whose deaths were mourned by local residents time after time. Mm-hmm. And you have a history that goes back all the way to the formation of this country. And so, you know, for people to finally come out and speak out about this and to be taken seriously after so many decades, after so long, certainly must have been an interesting time for you as a journalist to be part of it. You just talked about the naivete that you felt that your fellow journalists sort of displayed and realizing.
Myself included.
Yeah, then realizing that the system didn't work. And I want to hone in on the title of your book, Wesley. You say, "They Can't Kill Us All." You say that you became part of the story in Ferguson when you became the first to be arrested. You're an African-American man, but you're also a journalist who's expected to keep this objective distance from the stories you're covering. Why did you title your book, "They Can't Kill Us All"?
Well, first of all, I think that it's important to note that all of us journalists, writers, reporters, whomever, are real people. We cannot separate who we are from the work we do every day. And in fact, that we see the world that we live in through the eyes we have, right? And that my eyes might be different than yours. My experiences are likely different than yours. And while we strive for fairness and a level of objective fairness, right, the reality is we also know that the stories that we gravitate towards personally, the stories that we work harder on, the sources that we may have access to are determined in part by who we are and our backgrounds and our links. Now, "They Can't Kill Us All," as the title of the book, is in quotation marks. It's from a sign that was left outside of a shooting in St. Louis after Michael Brown was killed. It was left at a gas station where a young man named Antonio Martin was killed. Now, this was in December 2014. It was a time when it felt like the winds were shifting perhaps a little bit. It was either right before or right after two officers had been shot and killed in New York. It was something that people thought had taken some of the winds out of the sail of at the time, this infant protest movement, Black Lives Matter. And this was a shooting that many people argue would, quote unquote, a good police shooting, right? This was an armed person who was caught on tape pulling a gun on an officer. And so there was this question, and yet despite this, despite what the police saying and police putting this video out and the black elected officials saying, hey, we shouldn't protest this one, dozens of people were taking to the streets, eventually hundreds of people were taking to the streets, rallying around this young man. And there was a question. I had this question from a lot of readers, a lot of folks who follow me on the internet, who were saying, well, why are people rallying around this guy? Wasn't he a bad guy? Didn't he deserve this? And as we were thinking about the title of this book, which tries to trace the protest movement from Ferguson through the University of Missouri protest and eventually all the way up through the Republican National Convention last year, we were trying to capture what the feeling was inside 2014 and 2015, inside these last 2 years. And there was this feeling of defiance that the protesters, the individuals, were going out and they were showing in a show of strength and a show of unity that no, these police shootings have to stop, that they're happening too often. You can't kill all of us. You can't kill us all. And that wording came from a sign left at the gas station after Antonio Martin was killed next to one of the street posts. And it was in cardboard written, "They can't kill us all." And that's where this ended up coming from.
So you went back to Ferguson a year later after the protests first broke around the killing of Mike Brown. What did you find there? Was there slowing down of the momentum for calls for justice? And are you, is there slowing down today?
Well, I think that, one year removed And even 2 years removed, I think there was still a lot of frustration. The reform process in Ferguson was still moving very slowly. The police there certainly have implemented a significant number of changes. The department looks very different than it did previously. Although I think many of the residents still find frustration, not just in Ferguson, but in greater St. Louis County, right? I think sometimes we talk about these things in the context of a specific municipality. But the reality is, if you live in one municipality, it doesn't mean you don't ever drive in the next one. You're never interacting with the police in one or two over, right? And so you have an entire region, entire county, that has policing practices very similar to what Ferguson's always were. Now, a year ago, 2 years ago, is very different than today, right? We've had a change in the presidential administration, obviously. We have a new ideology in the Attorney General's office. To date, I don't know that the AG's office has launched a single major policing probe in the almost a year since Jeff Sessions became the Attorney General.
And they made it very clear they were not going to go after perpetrators of police brutality.
Yeah, so they don't believe it's the role of the federal government, essentially. I think this is a local government thing, and it's not their job. And in fact, the Attorney General has said very often that he thinks that he doesn't think these reports are well done, that he thinks they're anecdotal, and he thinks they seek to villainize the police, is what he said. And so it's unsurprising that we've not seen these investigations. What we also have seen from them is in large part, an abandonment of the active investigations that were happening, as well as the ongoing processes of reform. And so you have places like North Charleston, where Walter Scott was killed, where they had ordered a federal review, or the city had requested one. And the review is done, but the Attorney General refuses to release the information to the city, even though it's already been paid for and conducted. You have other cases, such as that of Eric Gardner, which is still open. The federal investigation is still open and has not been closed, despite the fact that that death happened years ago, right? And so it's still unclear whether or not the officer who killed Eric Gardner will be charged with a federal hate crime or not. Precedent tells us that we should be cautious and believe that it probably will not happen. But that said, this is an investigation that has continued to linger now almost for an entire year into a new administration without a decision about what's going to happen one way or the other.
So the story of Black Lives and Black Lives Matter and this movement that is formed of actually many organizations now on the ground, this is a story that has entered a new chapter with the Trump administration. Your book came out in late 2016 at a time when, you know, many were assuming we'd have a Clinton administration. Mm-hmm. And now, of course, we see a lot of progress, which was sort of a cultural progress more than actual progress, seemed to take a step back, seemed to be undone. The actual progress in terms of the federal government's investigations really being undone. But even the sort of cultural view of Black Lives Matter seems to have shifted pretty significantly in the context of increasing expressions of white supremacy. Are you worried that police brutality and this story that you spent a long time covering is simply going to be swept under the rug, that once more it's going to be something that doesn't get solved and is just forgotten?
You know, I don't know that police brutality will ever be forgotten, in part because it's something that occurs every day. Through our database project, what we saw was that there are 3 fatal police shootings every single day. And so because of that, in the era in which we live with cell phone videos, with social media, there will always be, every morning will be the morning that maybe a name will trend. Every morning will be a morning where maybe this is when we see the next worst video. But that said, it's unquestionably true that the current administration, the current political environment, has sucked a lot of the oxygen out of the room. And it's very difficult to talk about things that are not about President Trump. In fact, because he produces so much information, so much scandal, so many developments every single day, that it can be very difficult to have a focus on almost any other topic. That said, I think it's really interesting, the maturation and shift that some of the activists involved in Black Lives Matter have undergone, even in the last few months following the election of President Trump. I mean, many of these activists, some of them, not all of them, but many of them would have sworn off any engagement in electoral politics. Some of them famously refused to endorse a candidate. Some of them famously argued that Hillary Clinton might be as bad as Donald Trump would be as a president. I imagine most of them now regret those statements or would not make them again. That there's certainly been a shift. We've seen the launching even of some electoral political groups out of some of these young Black activists, with the understanding that it's great to be the the popular movement in the moment and have a lot of people supporting you and say they support you. But if you can't move votes and you don't wield actual political power, what happens when you no longer have a White House like that of Barack Obama, which was very sympathetic to the idea of Black Lives Matter, and when you encounter one that does not? That you no longer command audience with the commander-in-chief, you no longer have the ability to pressure the attorney general, and because of that, you lose a lot of the political power that existed previously. And so it's what's fascinating for me as an observer of this political movement is watching as it attempts to pivot to a space in which these organizations and these leaders have actual sustained political power as a means of elongating their ability to continue doing this work, because while there's certainly still support in the grassroots, and there's still a lot of, and I think only even more mobilized support because of kind of the outpouring of white supremacist violence over the last few years, I do think there's a real question about how is that power and this sentiment and this unity among the center left around the idea of Black Lives Matter, how is that mobilized into real political power?
Wesley, I want to thank you so much for spending this time with us and for joining us today.
Of course, thanks so much for having me.
My guest is Wesley Lowery, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for The Washington Post, covering law enforcement and justice. He was the Post's lead reporter in Ferguson, Missouri, when the Black Lives Matter movement broke into the national scene in the wake of Mike Brown's police killing. We've been discussing his book, They Can't Kill Us All, The Story of the Struggle for Black Lives, which was released in paperback in September 2017. When it came out, it became a New York Times bestseller. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. You can sign up for our daily newsletter there. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.